Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope that this works successfully tonight. I'm not sure if you can hear me or not. It's like I'm broadcasting from the road all over again, except I'm sitting in my house. So if you'd like to call in, it's area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. You're going to have to bear with me for a second because I'm trying to, my computer just crashed and I can't get into anything, and so I'm trying to find the materials that I wanted to talk about a little bit today, and these include a email from Dr. Ken Duckworth. I think it's Ken Duckworth, Dr. Duckworth, I think it's, well, the from NAMI, soliciting funds, soliciting donations from people in Robin Williams' name, and honor Robin Williams. And then Representative Tim Murphy's e-newsletter that has gone out and about. Yeah, I mean, this is really troubling. So if you're live radio, folks, just remember, if you'd like to call in, area code 267-521-0167, 267-521-0167, if you'd like to call in. Okay, so while my computer is sitting here trying to reopen itself, and I hope that I was successful in even coming online, I want to, let's start with Congressman Murphy. Okay, so in this week's edition of E! News from Congressman Murphy, the first link opens to an article called Actor Robin Williams' Death Renews Call for Reform. That's what it says. Actor Robin Williams' death renews call for reform. This is not me. This is in this week's edition of E! News from Congressman Tim Murphy. The death of celebrated actor Robin Williams this week renewed public focus on the need to reform the nation's flawed and long-neglected mental health system. And renewed public focus actually opens up into a link. And that link is from an article on August 12, 2014, Lawmaker Urges Mental Health Reforms After Robin Williams' Death. And, of course, the link doesn't allow you to go back in. Okay, and the first line of that, it's by Elise Vivek. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name wrong. It's in The Hill. And it says, Representative Tim Murphy on Tuesday called for action on mental health reform in response to the death of actor Robin Williams. Murphy said, this is a quote, the first line, quote, perhaps Robin Williams' greatest gift to us, if we choose to accept it, is a focused determination to help those with brain illness and finally take real action to stop the loss of one more precious life, Murphy, Representative Pennsylvania, said in a statement. So, sorry, long dramatic pause, maybe too long for radio, I'm still here. Thanks for listening. I hope you're having a great night out there, and if you'd like to call in and talk with me about this or anything else, the number to call in is area code 267-521-0167, and area code 970, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren.
Yes.
Okay. You know, Murphy, he's not a senator, I realize that, but he feels, he's touting the benefits of psychiatry, like there are no zero problems with psychiatry or symptom side effects to all this so-called treatment that everybody needs. Okay?
Yeah.
A, treatment is not easy. Okay? They make it sound like, you know, go into treatment and your problems are gone. Doesn't happen that way. It's just the start of a long road to hoe under the best circumstances. Never mind if the medicines don't work and your side effects aren't extreme. And he's ignoring the fact that it's not even hidden. Every antidepressant has a warning. May cause worsening of symptoms and it lowers the resistance to suicide. So, you know, Robin Williams could have been on all the drugs that were prescribed for him, and that didn't that wouldn't have saved him from suicide. Actually, it can increase the risk of suicide. And people really don't know. It's not talked about on the internet over and over again. The highest, I learned this years ago, that the highest risk for suicide in a depressed person is once they started medications. Forget that the medications may cause the suicide, but once they start feeling a little bit better, then there's that period of time that they have the energy, the bear for a wall, and to actually commit suicide while when they were
Complete suicide.
You know, when a person's super-duper-duper-duper depressed, they don't necessarily commit suicide then. It's when they're on the upswing a little bit and they have the energy and a little more thought about. You know, my life is pretty crummy. Even if I'm feeling really well today, I know what's coming in another week or month or year. I'll have the
impending doom. Absolutely. And that is the most.
What is it if I'm feeling good now?
Yeah.
If I'm going to face it again in a couple of years?
It's a basic human reality. I was trying to look for the right word.
Depression is, yes.
Well, being sad, being dissatisfied, being hurt, being afraid, being unable to know which way to go, or not having the resources or access to go the way that you know you need to go. I mean, it's what they medicalize as quote-unquote depression. Or dealing with, some kind of terminal illness or something that is, overshadowed with, grimness. And for anybody who may be there are ways to push through and hang on and to get the life you want. But it's also, it's cruel and mean and cruel, inhuman treatment to suggest to the average person that these feelings aren't
normal.
That they aren't real, that they aren't part of the human experience. Humans experience 6 or 7 basic emotions, and 5 out of the 6 or 7 of them are negative. It's one of those things that the way that this is being positioned as if this is what Murphy is now calling brain illnesses, and suggesting that Robin Williams had a brain illness
or disease, which is a different word, but people see differently than illness. Usually, when you have an illness, you recover. A disease, very few people recover from. Okay. So you hear that they're both words, but disease means different things to people than illness. Because I recuperate from an illness. Very few people recuperate. In other words, you live your life sometimes with diseases. You don't live your life with illnesses. Okay? Usually, if you have frequent illnesses, it's because of a disease. But the other thing about depression, a lot of people don't know, and it's not put out there. You cannot, if they follow the DSM, they cannot diagnose you with clinical depression until these feelings are constant without interruption for 2 weeks or more for depression. Another illness, brain illnesses, disorders, whatever, that they diagnose, it's even longer. Sometimes it's 6 months. But people don't know that. And doctors often will diagnose you even without a persistent case of feeling depressed and suicidal. And the other thing people don't understand is if you attempt suicide, you don't necessarily get a mental health diagnosis. I know many people who've attempted suicide and never got a mental health diagnosis. So you don't have to be mentally ill to commit suicide. And you don't have to be depressed to commit suicide. Now, I'm not talking about an upswing of depression. I'm talking about I must have had at least half a dozen suicide attempts while I was manic. And it was even more impulsive. It usually is in, I'm usually very happy. But also know, because after all, I'm bipolar, I'm going to come down from this. And that whole thought is more terrible than being high.
See, I've got to interrupt you there for a second and say that is so real to me, because I usually say when I'm particularly on the low end of my spectrum that I am going to bounce back so much higher than last time.
Well,
this is so much worse.
That too.
I understand that. And that these are real things that people experience, and that this is part of being human, and that this is the human reality. And when you're living in a capitalist, environment where so many of these issues can be not all, but so many of these issues can be mm-hmm. resolved by having your basic needs met. And if you can buy your basic needs, also having the things that you can get, whether you have money or not. Do you know what I mean? That this is part of it. That people having real relationships is part of it, and that those relationships need to be seen as.
And the thing is they're focusing a lot on depression. Let's face it, Lauren. You and I both know. I don't know a psychiatric diagnosis that's common. I mean, a schizophrenic who attempts suicide, are they depressed? Tell me, are they depressed or are they schizophrenic?
I don't know, because I don't know that either of those things really exist in terms of any actual way.
I understand, okay? But I'm talking about someone like Murphy who is saying these things exist, okay? So if these things exist and depression is horrible and the answer is medication, what about the side effects of medication?
Well, the side effects of medication is to cause you to be more depressed, to be able to get all kinds of anxiety and other kinds of real serious issues if you try to get off of the drugs, and to cause you to be have a higher risk of suicidality. The black box warning. So.
Yeah. But my experience, and everybody's experience is different. I'm not going to argue that, but I'll tell you, I mostly dealt with mood swings and long periods of having suicidal thoughts. That's it, when I sought help. After I started medications, well, the very first drug, which isn't even on the market anymore, caused me to twitch and turn after two doses, and it took 2 weeks to work my body out of that before my body stopped twitching and shaking. Like, I could hardly walk. That's how bad it was. And then they just put me on another drug, and within a month of starting their drugs, I was cutting and burning. I was acting reckless. I was more manic than I had ever been. Or, we all know when we do manic things, but...
Do you mean like excited
no.
or joyous
no.
or happy or
I mean, let's face it, there are times where you feel joyous, happy, and then there's times, at least for me, there's times when I can clearly, but I'll tell you, when I can clearly say this is mania, it was only after I started taking medications. And one of the side effects of any mood stabilizer is mania, regardless if you have unipolar depression or not. You know, which people don't realize that. You could have unipolar depression and take antidepressants and become manic, even
unipolar
if you're not diagnosed
depression.
As bipolar.
Oh.
Right, even if you're not diagnosed as bipolar, okay? You could have unipolar depression and take an antidepressant and become manic. Now, it might not be the mania I feel as a bipolar, and this is all if you agree. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I don't know how to use the terms to explain myself.
Okay,
except
so,
in the way,
okay.
You know what I'm saying? To totally disagree with what has been said is really like 2 years old for me, and I haven't talked much about it. I've talked a lot to you about it, but not outside of the show. I haven't talked a lot about it. So I still have those old terms, and I apologize for that. But
no, that's okay. That's okay, because I think that that's part of, I mean, like, I'm just looking at the 1982 Declaration of Principles, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so anger, hostility, enthusiasm, mania, joy, euphoria, fear, paranoia, sadness, unhappiness, depression, visual, spiritual experience, hallucination, nonconformity, schizophrenia, unpopular belief, delusion.
Well, with mania, with me mostly is... It's not insomnia, per se, because maybe I'll get a couple hours sleep, but it's definitely the lack of sleep, but it's not even so much that I'm not sleeping. It's like, there's no need to sleep. I mean, how many of us have had,
but why is that a problem? That's only
a
problem because society says it's a problem.
Oh, I'm not, and society doesn't even say it's a problem. Psychiatry says it's a problem.
Well, psychiatry says it's a problem. Fair enough, because
yeah.
I grew up in, like, the city that never slept. You know what I mean? New York
right.
City. That was its motto,
yeah.
The city
that
never sleeps.
I mean, definitely. I grew up in a family that, you know, when we celebrated, when we were joyous, whether it was the holidays, a wedding, a special occasion, an anniversary, big anniversary or whatever, if we didn't sleep for the 2 days or something like that, that was normal for us. And no one questioned it. No one thought, oh, you're getting sick because you didn't sleep hardly anything for 2 days. You know, these are just things people do. But the whole pretense of psychiatry is not to make what's normal. They want to take what's normal and make it an illness. Because what better way to get money? I mean, because if everybody does it, then everybody's sick.
Right.
You know what
and
I'm saying?
And if we took the profit out of it today, tomorrow, there would be very little psychiatry and almost, then absolutely
right.
No forced psychiatry.
Well, and the thing that hurts me, though, is to hear Murphy talk about this, and he tries to come all across as compassionate, and the problem is, mostly, is people believe them.
Right.
People, in general, don't say, can you listen to yourself? What are you saying? You're saying that, I mean, because if people were to really listen, they don't believe they're the one with the mental illness, okay? And let's face it, there's some things that are quote-unquote symptoms that just is, you know, you go through a rough time, something periodical. And some people put a lot of morality into some of these symptoms. And so psychiatrists realized that and said, oh, but it's not because you're a morally horrible person or these are things that are out of your control and you have a chemical imbalance, so we're going to give you medications and
yes,
then the moral issues out of your hands anymore. Now, I'm not saying things I do are morally wrong. I'm saying some people feel bad because they have some of the symptoms and they feel that it's normal behavior, but society says, you know, that's morally wrong.
Right, like
I mean,
up until 1978, being gay or lesbian was a
I thought it was
a quote-unquote mental illness. Like,
right.
And it was taken out of the DSM. So it's, but and then also in the 1850s with the era of moral treatments that the Quakers came in and that if people had pastoral environments and had space to, you know, the creation of the asylums after they exposed what was happening, you know, where we were being
right.
chained to walls and,
well, and
with bales
and
of hay for beds in the poorhouses. So the government is constantly, yeah, and the way Murphy is doing this, I agree with you. He's making it seem like he's, you know, well, when he's not seeming totally arrogant,
yes.
like he's somehow benevolent inside of this whole thing.
Yes.
But
well,
the way
and
that they're all...
talking about moral hospitals, and I'm telling you, family members love to hear that, but the thing is, moral hospitals do not... I don't know about you, Lauren, and I'm pretty sure I can say this with safety that you could agree with this. Hospitals didn't really help.
No,
it might,
no.
It
hospitals hurt
maybe.
People. Thank
yeah,
you, David Chapin,
I mean,
and Architecture Research
no...
Construction. Hospitals hurt people. These are bad places. And Olmsted is being completely ignored in this process. I mean, the simple fact that Olmsted exists and that Murphy is putting
Olmsted
this forward.
Well, Olmsted is not hospitals. Homesteads are mostly nursing homes. Now,
well,
yes,
no, well, any a hospital or any institutions. I mean,
right.
in New York, anyway, that's the way we treat it.
But you got to remember, there aren't so many long-term treatment facilities anymore, at least in Colorado. They closed most of them down. There's only two, and a lot of people really aren't state hospital people, but they're not independent and community people, according to psychiatry. And they end up in nursing homes with less
right.
regulation than even the psych hospitals. And their freedoms are restricted. They're in mock
right.
ward.
Oh,
In nursing homes.
Yeah, no, and in New York, nursing homes don't they meet the requirements of Olmsted and need to be shut down. But I'm saying like I don't disagree with you that these are all terrible places. Any kind of place. What people need is community, natural environments, and places of where they are accepted and that people's gifts and talents are appreciated and utilized.
And
Murphy never talks about any of that.
Of course. The thing is, the people who are really voting, he's not thinking a person, because he talks a lot about young people. And these people may be able to vote 18 or older. You only have to be 18 and no other requirement to vote. But kids just entering college or just graduating high school, they don't think about voting so much on the average. Okay, I did. I actually voted before I was out of high school. But he's really talking to the parents and the quote-unquote loved ones of the mentally ill.
Right.
So because everybody thinks the person who's mentally ill at least needs a short stay in a hospital. And that is really the problem in some circumstances. I don't care if it's... A luxury psychiatric hospital or the state hospital in whatever state you're in, psychiatric hospitals, I've never known anyone to be there the first time, no matter what level, because I've been in all levels, that wasn't like, what? You're going to make me, I can't tie my shoes, I can't wear my belt, I can't leave, I'm locked in here. I can't make a phone call, or
right.
sometimes you can't make a phone call, or I have to have money. Some of the private hospitals, they have phones, but you have to pay to make that phone call. And I have to have a roommate that is, what? I'm not sick. And, of course, that's part of your illness when you say I'm not sick. And I've never met anyone who's been in the hospital the first time that wasn't totally shocked, belittled, and even more depressed once they got there and realized what was happening. So, okay, and then NAMI exploiting a dead man is horrible. And I wrote it on a comments on your post. I can just see him his skit where he goes, fuck it all, excuse my language, but You know, and I mean, if there's such thing as turning in your grave, I imagine he would be doing that, because I cannot see that he would, for one minute, believe that that what is being done is beneficial. I mean, people somehow, the implication that it's beneficial, and I'm sure there's many people who buy psychiatry, hook, line, and sinker, think this is a very good thing, that he's accomplishing something in his death. But I don't think he was pro-psychiatry, personally. I'm sure he was under a lot of pressure to take psych drugs, but not that he himself, I mean, you don't even do a comedy kit.
I don't even know what he was or wasn't doing. I don't think anybody knows what he was or wasn't doing. I don't think a toxicology report has been released. I have no idea what, you know what I mean? Like, that this is... that this is part of it, is that it's something. And part of what annoys me about that NAMI letter is that, you know, remembering Robin Williams signed Dr. Ken Duckworth, the medical director of NAMI, and in bold it says, as someone who gave so much of himself to others, Robin struggled privately with addiction and severe depression, which can distort your thinking and make a period of depression feel endless. Robin struggled privately with Dr. Ken Duckworth, his psychiatrist. How does anybody know this? Where are his medical records?
I've seen skits where he talks at least about his addiction and his struggles, okay, with that. Okay, so he wasn't all so private as they like to think. Now, this whole thing is with his wife saying what he was currently struggling with was a diagnosis with Parkinson's, and we can go into a real rabbit hole with that discussion. But
agreed.
But I don't know if you saw him. When you're on air, I don't know if you see what's on your page. Because yesterday, I really wanted to see if I could find the answer to that question about not assisted suicide, because that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a person, and they don't always have to be diagnosed with a mental illness,
right,
but they are diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. Okay?
We did talk about it a little while. I don't know if you heard.
I might have fallen asleep.
At the end, I did ask, and I did specify that clarifier, that not necessarily about assisted suicide. And we agree that this is a very emotional conversation, and maybe we should have it and put a call out to specifically have it one night or over a series of nights or years. But the question in terms of that, Tina suggested, we're trying to get a transcript of that show, actually.
Right.
And if anybody wants to transcribe it, any good transcribers out there who want to volunteer and transcribe that show so that it can get out to different networks, particularly of people who have disabilities, that would be awesome. But what she was talking about was that it becomes a legal capacity issue. And so since they can't take your legal capacity away from you, they can't say that you're, quote-unquote, too sick to make a decision, that the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities would probably protect that under legal capacity.
I'll tell you what's happened to me. Not that it's exactly what I was talking about, because it's something I do fear, because I am queer, and I'm as rational as I'm ever going to be right this minute. If I were to get my cousin, a year older than me, has ALS, okay? Now,
okay.
She chose that she was going to deal with it and live to the very end, but she lives on a ventilator. She is totally, and there's nothing they can do for her, but she's only alive because of machines and constant care, okay? That's not something I would want. So once my lungs were going to drown themselves and a need for a ventilator would happen, I wouldn't want that life-saving treatment to be administered to me. But because I also have quote unquote, an existing mental illness, my biggest fear is that they would ignore my wishes and keep my body alive because they have the ability to keep my body alive.
Right. I believe that was the situation I posed to Tina. And what the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities does is it makes it impossible for them to take any decision away from you based on legal capacity, that you always have legal capacity to make a decision.
So the way it is now, that's the situation,
it would null them having the ability to do that, and that you would still be able.
Even if you have an existing mental health diagnosis?
I believe that the CRPD does that. If you write the specific question, and I'm sure Tina will be happy to answer it.
Yeah.
And she's going to come on again and do another show and talk about more about this because I'm just as, you know,
well,
yeah.
Something everybody's asked is a DNR, right?
Right.
Now, okay, I was asked one time when I had pneumonia that if, you know, the doctor was like, well, there's really no chance of this happening, but I have to ask you this question. Okay, what is the question? Well, if you need resuscitation, do you want resuscitation? I told her no. And then I agreed to it because I was afraid she was going to put me on a psychiatric hold. I was already a mental health patient at the time. But the implicate, because she goes, oh, but you're a young woman. I may be a young woman, and maybe pneumonia is a temporary situation, but 100 years ago, if I had pneumonia and stopped breathing, there would have been no option to revive me, and that's my criteria. I also am a big believer, if it's my time to go, no matter what you do, doctor, I'm going to go, you know? And that doesn't mean I'm going to tempt or tempt fate by doing something so I can go. I'm beyond that point, thank God, that I'm beyond that point. I'm not going to attempt my own life anymore. But
I
do want the option to refuse, quote-unquote, life-saving treatment because, let's face it, even chemotherapy is considered life-saving treatment. But I'm sorry, if I have cancer and there's no other option but radiation and chemotherapy, then I want to go quietly in my own home, not go through the torture of chemo and radiation. But that's
right,
me. That's
right.
My personal choice. And I don't have a husband, and I don't have children, and I don't have grandchildren to think about or miss or, you know, not be there for. So my decision is going to be different than someone who has that. What I get angry at is to be told I don't have that choice regardless of my situation. And that's what really bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that really brings up interesting points, and I wonder, in the advance directive, there is a section that you have to, in order for the advance directive to be filled, you have to have a DNR decision made and on file in it. And so... I wonder if somebody, same situation, if somebody would say that they don't want to, you know, that they signed the DNR, they're saying they don't want to be resuscitated, if that then would prevent the advance directive from going through because somebody would think that, yeah, I see exactly what you're saying.
Well, and the other thing is, though, Lauren, not for anything, but I don't know... my experience in medicine, whether it be psychiatry or mainstream medicine, leads me to believe I could have advanced directives for every single situation that could possibly come upon me in my life, and I don't believe any of it would be followed. They would still go to a family member and say, oh, should we do this or do that? I really don't think they would, even if it was, you know, signed by Jesus Christ himself, if you're religious, okay, as the witness, and it's been notarized and everything. I really don't think doctors would follow through. Let's face it. about that case in Florida with the woman whose husband wanted nutrition to be stopped, Shiloh or something like that. And
yeah.
We had to go through court
Terry
after
Schiavo.
Court. And
yeah.
I'm almost certain, because what, I mean, I don't doubt. I know his motives were very, very much in question, but I don't doubt at a time in her life she told him, if I end up like that, I don't want to continue to live. I want to just be let to die.
And yet I know that this is also a contentious issue in the disability community, certainly across all communities, where there have been very deep conversations about then having the fear that if this thing, these kinds of things are allowable, then it allows family members to just say that this
should be a person's choice.
But
a lot of things should be a person's choice, and then in the end, fine document or not, they're not followed. I mean, someone put it on the internet, I won't mention, I know who did it, but someone put on the internet that if I were to walk in a psychotic moment, I don't want them to ask me if I want treatment, I just want them to treat me. And she believes in mainstream psychiatry. But, you know, just because that would be your choice doesn't mean it has to be law.
I say that those are the exact kind of situations that should be put in advance directives. You want to be forced into it? This is how you want it to happen? Go for it. Put that down.
And
write that down. Leave the rest of us alone.
Advance directive, though.
Like,
I mean, today.
Like, this shouldn't,
today.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, and Murphy, quite frankly, he isn't concerned about us. He doesn't care about the people who are going to be subjected to this. This is about helping families in mental health crisis, quote-unquote. This is about making it easier to have our privacy limited and to remove possibilities for advocacy. This is supported by the family members who discount any kind of abuse model or trauma model or any of that. Or an environment that they discount any of that as a possibility, that it just must be. Of course, they never, I guess, think of where the genes come from, right? Like.
Right. Well, and the thing is, I will tell you, as far as that goes, coming from a family where my grandmother and not only her, my grandmother, some of her children and some of her grandchildren all been diagnosed with bipolar, I think families who have the history are a little even more set upon getting treatment because my mother might have passed it on because it was her mother. Regardless, they want you to be treated. You know, they don't take the personal responsibility, while other parents, because of trauma, they would be more defensive. Oh, no, I didn't make my kid mentally ill. While someone with a genetic history, it's more accepted. I may have passed it on to her, but I had nothing to do with it. I didn't cause it. So those parents really, I mean, that's what they're mostly filled with, NAMI. I've been around NAMI people. A lot of those NAMI people, there is a strong genetic link, quote-unquote, if you believe in that. And
right,
that's where they're still.
And it's just a theory.
I mean, the whole thing is a theory. But the thing that's really sad and, you know, scary for those of us who say, hey, think about what you're saying, because, you know, this doesn't make sense. Really think about this. But when you say those things, people say, well, you've been diagnosed with a mental illness. You're not going to understand. And, you know, it's what is a person to do? I don't know. I'm working these things out myself. But I do know one thing, that I do have rights to live my life as I see fit. And so far, I've been getting away with living my life the way I want it. But I tell you, I mean, even against the wishes of doctors and therapists, okay? And I'm not way out in la-la land doing destructive things to anybody or myself, but I'm pretty sure the reason why I'm pretty much left alone is because I don't have a husband, children, grandchildren, or others, and any siblings are 2,000 miles away. They don't know what I do from day to day. Otherwise, I might have been interfered with. And as long as people know, it doesn't matter what the illness is. No one wants to be told how it has to be treated, or you can be forced to be treated. You know?
And I think that's, you know, that's the biggest part of the problem to me is the idea that psychiatry is going to somehow resolve this. In terms of that which is the most natural thing for people to experience. When Carl Jung was writing that you must know the darkness in yourself if you are to understand and, you know, the darkness in others. Like the idea of seeing the idea of seeing a baby bird on the street with a broken wing and having that moment of where you can pick it up and it's in the palm of your hand and you can decide to either do one or two things of it. One very dark, and the other try to help it heal. Right? That this is Carl Jung. That until humanity truly acknowledges that people have the capacity to have a thought without acting on it, and to have these thoughts are natural and part of our human experience, that nobody will really be able to truly heal. The lies that people are told in terms of what psychiatry can do. That when as you brought up before with the side effects, for example, of these drugs, that you know that it causes somebody to become increased suicidality, and then even that other point that you brought up, which I think is so important, about if it, you know, you start to feel a little bit better because now you're on a drug, right? So and so you have just enough energy, you know, like these are. Things, and I don't think that any of these people that are making these laws have the first clue as to about what's really necessary.
Well, that's what scares me the most, that people think suicide only happens in depression, and
right.
It doesn't
right.
in the first place. And, you know, I'll tell you, when I first started feeling suicidal and decided that I needed to do something about it, before I even went to my first psychiatric appointment, I went to the library and got books out. And I mean, this is before the Internet. And I looked what suicide was. And I'm glad it wasn't Internet times because there's so much misleading stuff on the Internet. But
yeah.
I never thought, oh, I can't commit suicide because I'm going to go to hell. I thank God that would never even cross my mind that I'd go to hell, because I think a lot of people who think that, they say, well, I'm living in a hell, which so what? I'm going to go to hell, big deal. You know, I never thought I would find peace, per se, like people saying, I mean, someone on the Internet was very valid in saying, you know, may he have freedom or may he have peace now. You know, who knows what comes after death? I have my beliefs. And, you know, my belief in God, God wouldn't say kill yourself so you have peace now. He'd want you to find it here. If you don't believe in God, you're taking just as much risk of killing yourself as you are staying here. So, you know, really, I mean, if you don't believe in the God, your chances of finding peace after death is very little. You cease to exist as a person, but is that peace? I've been so weirded out on psychiatric drugs that I'll tell you, your body may be still, your mind may be mush, but that is not peace. I mean, I may be docile compared to when I'm manic or doing something that may or may not be destructive in reality, but that doesn't give peace. My biggest peace was when I faced my enemy of suicide and depression and mania and said, so what? you're not going to tear me down. And if you continue along this downward slide, I'm going to have faith that I'm coming out of it. Because I'll tell you, there's nothing like getting through those times, going to the other side, and knowing actually life is still there, you know. It could be good, it could be bad, but it's still there, you know. And reality is when I die or, you know, anyone dies, other people still continue to live. The world doesn't cease, you know, that whole thing of
right, you still have the right to defend yourself,
knowing,
if you're,
you know.
Right, you still have the ability to defend yourself if you're alive. But that's the one thing, like, that's the one thing that I feel like you said before, like, you could hear him saying, fuck it all, you know, too miserable to do something today, fuck it all. Like, the one thing he no longer has is the right to defend himself. And I really think
if he thought this kind of stuff would happen after his death, he would have lived despite all this crap. If I knew this was going to happen after I did a suicide, I mean, I'm not nearly even one drop of the celebrity Robin Williams was, but if he thought groups like NAMI, and I'm sure if he has heard of NAMI, he wasn't a stupid or an ignorant person, if he had thought of groups like NAMI or psychiatrist. I really don't think he found psychiatry a friend from what I have seen him, his skits, his just trying to talk normally. I don't think he found psychiatry as a friend, and it's certainly not drugs a friend, but I think he might not have done it if he knew what the results would be, because it's tarnished who he was.
Yeah, absolutely.
He was a man that gave us joy. Whatever else happened in the circumstances of his death really shouldn't matter. The fact that he's no longer here to be the actor, the comedian, because let's face it, he was... as great as a comedian he was a fantastic dramatic actor, too. So he knew how not to be crazy. He was a remarkable man, and all of a sudden this remarkable man is now being toted more about the way he died than the way he lived. And then it's all according to who you're talking to, okay? As far as the Internet goes, there's a whole lot more about, you know, go seek help, don't suffer, and you know, because the assumption is he suffered a long time in silence and he had no one to confide in or go to. No one knows that, and I'm sure his wife finds that very offensive. He never kept his problems secret. He never did. Everybody knew. I mean, how could you not know? And he openly talked about his alcoholism and his use of drugs. If not out and out saying he was manic depressive, who wouldn't think he wasn't? Okay? And just the assumption that everybody who is depressed can commit suicide. There are a ton of people who are depressed who have never even thought of suicide. Okay? And that doesn't mean you shouldn't talk about suicide, but there are people who are depressed that particular symptom of being suicidal is not one of the things that...
Again, I mean, because it's not really a symptom and that it's not really a thing. I mean, I think that this is a very personal kind of experience that people have, and whether or not they, you know, follow through on it, and it's usually a huge loss to society. But I think that not everybody who, you know, quote unquote, complete suicide is got a, you know, something that's psychiatric, because there's nothing that's psychiatric that is legitimately real.
Well, and someone on my
It's a cluster of, descriptions of behaviors that people exhibit. Like, that's, you know what I mean? That's
right.
So, But, I mean, I think that that NAMI is, I mean, and for anybody who wasn't listening yesterday and who might have missed this, you know, they are literally, so in this email it says, almost as soon as the news broke, many NAMI supporters made memorial donations in honor of Robin or Mork or even Oh Captain, My Captain. Others were inspired to call the NAMI helpline to volunteer. And when you click on the memorial donations page from this NAMI email about Robin Williams, it takes you right to a donation page for NAMI. How is this anything that, you know, on any way legitimate on in any way or whatsoever?
Well, and the thing is, someone wrote on Facebook, Robin Williams was a good man no matter what, how he died. And I'm like, whoever said he was bad? So, you know, people just, there's assumptions that a person who would commit suicide is a bad person. A person who would be depressed is a bad person. A person who has a mental health diagnosis, be a psychiatrist, is bad. And that's the stigma that psychiatry is fighting. But the thing is, there's a bigger stigma because psychiatry is wrong. You know, it is just wrong. People have issues. People can work through those issues. They don't need drugs. And, you know, you always get the argument, what about a schizophrenic? Well, I don't know about schizophrenics before psychiatric meds, but I can almost guarantee schizophrenics of today who are on antipsychotics, which, by the way, you don't have to be
neuroleptic.
A schizophrenic.
I mean, the language is just killing me.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to do that. But you got to understand, even, and I know you have a lot of people who can talk the way you're, but there's a lot of people out there that, I mean, it's not that, I really don't know how to put the words together to make it more, and it shouldn't be about the words. It should be about that people are being abused by the so-called psychiatry. And anti-psychiatry shouldn't be about what particular words we use, because let's face it, if we're going to get our points across, we need to talk the language of the common
person. I know, but
there
was a point in time, but it is somewhat about the words that we use, and there were points in times when we didn't use, when people thought that we didn't need to worry about the language that we use concerning other words. And so it is the same kind of thing on some levels. And, I mean, again, it's not anti-psychiatry. I'm not opposed to anti-psychiatry, but anti-psychiatry and psychiatric survivors are two different movements that sometimes work together. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. I think it's as just hearing repeatedly somebody say schizophrenic over and over again, to me, is like somebody using an epithet about somebody, some other oppressed group.
Oh, I definitely.
Do you know what I mean?
That's
and
a dirty
like,
word in psychiatry, and that's what they always go back to. And what the point I was trying to make, and maybe you could forgive me on this, is they always want to go back to that truly rare schizophrenic diagnosis, okay? And the thing is, I don't know a bipolar person who isn't on medications they give to schizophrenics, okay? Whether those are proper terms or whatever, you know, the point is, this is whatever diagnosis has been put on your head, it's all a lie, okay?
Yeah.
And somehow, whatever way it took, and it took that millions of dollars to do this, psychiatry has gotten some legitimacy in the general public. And basically, I'm a raving lunatic to some people because, after all, persons that can't accept their diagnosis is actually the worst kind of mentally ill person because they're the most dangerous. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I'm not saying this is correct, Please. I mean, yes, but I'm just trying to get a point across.
I know. We're using dirty language.
I mean no offense to you at all.
And it's no offense to you either. And Maria, I got to say, there's nothing to apologize about. It's just that I think that on some levels, I really enjoy talking with you, and I think that you bring so much to attention that really deserves and needs people to pay attention to. So I appreciate you calling in and talking. And so please don't ever feel like you have to apologize. It's just like the fraud that this even exists, this thing. And so, yeah, everybody's on neuroleptics. Everybody's on, because they'll say, like, bipolar, you know, quote-unquote bipolar with quote-unquote psychosis. You need to be on, Gidone or Seroquel or Thorazine or Haldol or whatever they're pushing in you this week, or Sparrow.
Mm-hmm.
On top of, or the Abilify with the other, so everybody's getting everything, and I think technically I think that these are huge parts of the problem, is that that it's all, regardless of what it is you're assigned with, that you wind up getting hurt by what it is they give you, and that they have some kind of answer for any of this, I think is always the thing that is most concerning to me. And that, you said it earlier, that, you know, he's winning the public over, Murphy.
It's scary because I thought we pretty much could say that Bill was dead until this. I thought in my mind, whether that was truth or not, I don't know. But after seeing him on the internet today, I'm like, oh my gosh, with the events of recent days, he sounds like the next pope or a saint that needs to be canonized, or, you know, at least he sounds very sincere. But I've had a lot of sincere psychiatrists before, but I wouldn't trust them as far as I could go them, so to speak, because they too have been misled. I would prefer to think my public health psychiatrist is not just after the money like some of the more famous ones are, or the experts in court, but that they truly have been duped themselves. But I, in certain cases, I do think even regular MDs have been duped, because there are certain standards that you have to follow or you don't get paid.
Absolutely.
I mean, that doesn't just exist in psychiatry. It exists in regular mainstream medicine, too. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that the mainstream press that Murphy is getting, I mean, in this email, e-news from his office, he was in four or five different, USA Today, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, WTAE TV, some other thing, going to be on Sunday edition of, you know, Channel 2, whatever. So he's all over TV and newspapers, right? And so that builds his air of legitimacy even mm-hmm. further, that what he's doing is going, and then riding it out on you know, if only Robin had been aware,
Oh, come on. Really? If he had been aware of what? What wasn't he aware of? Come on. I mean,
well,
really.
Just because
he was successful at his suicide doesn't mean he was not fully aware of what was going on.
Yeah, it says that now it's a bipartisan. So this is interesting how they're spinning this. Representative Murphy's bipartisan Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act, H.R. 3717, includes a provision that would advance research efforts at the National Institute of Mental Health to identify and understand the causes and risk factors for suicide and links to mental illnesses like depression. And so that FKA2 gene that we were talking about the other night, watch out, folks. I bet they would be biting at the bit to be able to test his blood to see if he has FK2 infringement, and if he does, then to follow it along and call it the Robin Williams drug, which would leave him totally rolling in his grave. I feel like this is, we don't know why he did this or what happened or what the cause was or any of that, and that they're using this in this way. You know, where they say in the article, mental illness is a contributing factor in 90% of suicides. So even according to them, 10% of people who complete suicide, that quote-unquote mental illness has nothing to do with it. So why
right.
are
and
they...
Right, and that's to say that it's a higher number than that, but they conceded with... In other words, it could be even as 50-50, okay? A lot of times suicide is done impulsively. I know I've been there. I've been there where it was a very sterling moment, but that was only after certain psych drugs. So I really account my impulsive suicide attempts as totally being from the drugs. But that's besides the point. The point is that, you know, there's a million reasons why a person would actually go through a suicide, okay, and be successful at it. Now, it's the way I believe, and it's just me, if he wasn't supposed to die when he died, regardless if it was a suicide or not, he wouldn't have died. Because I'm telling you, I've had at least 30 attempts myself, and some of them are serious than others, and apparently, you know, he tried more than one way. But what truly happened, only Robin knows, okay? And, you know, it somehow tarnishes who he was for these mental health organizations to use the opportunity of his suicide, not his death, but his suicide in this manner. Because, let's face it, suicide can only be prevented by the person who is suicidal. No one else can stop a suicide. And let's face it, if a person is so darn suicidal that they attempt it like I did, or even more frequently, I've seen people try more than I have, the problem is not being addressed. I mean, part of it, I'm certain, part of the rapid cycling into suicidal thoughts was the drugs themselves.
I mean, who knows?
I'm almost certain.
Yeah, I mean, for your own experience.
Right.
You know, like, I mean, and who would know better than you? I certainly wouldn't know.
Right.
But I think it's important for people to realize what a freaking, this makes me so mad. On the postgazette.com, on August 13th, and this is one of the articles that was linked in Murphy's little e-news showing off all the media coverage he got. It's an article called Depression, a Disease That Conceals Hope. Mental illness and substance abuse made Robin Williams especially vulnerable. And this was by Joe Smido for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And so there's a quote from Murphy saying, quote, "It's the disease that causes you to give up hope," Mr. Murphy said in an interview. "It's the disease that blinds you to understanding you can get better." And so there it is, the disease, you know, the brain illness that causes a disease that you will never be lifted from.
Lauren,
what a freaking horrible message to send out. How irresponsible is Murphy to say that to anybody, to put that in the public press in that way, that because you have this quote unquote disease, that's what is going to give up hope and that you're doomed to it. Like, anybody who's out there who's heard this, disregard this nasty, misleading bullshit. Sorry,
Lauren. Lauren, have you ever yourself been suicidal at all?
From the time I was 7.
Okay.
I remember the very first time when I was 7.
Yeah. Not every time, but definitely certain times that I have attempted suicide, it was because I had a hope in me of another life. I'm not saying my whole time I was suicidal, I believed in an afterlife. But I tell you, I wasn't always hopeless. Sometimes I was like, okay, I'm impatient. I know there is another life. My hope is in the other life, not in this life. And so hope itself, it's really the individual. So, and, you know, no one wants to be thought of, even if you admit to being hopeless, because that's one of the questions they ask you when they determine if you're suicidal or not. If you feel hopeless or helpless, which I got every 6 weeks a questionnaire to see if I was suicidal like that, no one wants to admit they have hopelessness feelings or helplessness feelings until they're really, 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 really in that state of mind. And then after 20 years, I would be afraid to tell them. I wouldn't be honest about it. Because if they really thought I was at risk of suicide, what do they do, Lauren? What do they do if they really
think
they
lock you up and they take away all of your
you can't make a phone call, you can't decide
where to go, when to go, who to speak to, and you're locked in a room. All of your stuff taken away from you, put in a plastic box. I mean, but it's the disease that causes you to give up hope. It's the disease that blinds you to understanding. I really hope I can find a voice clip of that, because I'm gonna dupe it again and play it. Because they have no idea. They just have no idea. And when things are in people's, that psychiatry is going to give somebody hope. I mean, what bigger fraud is there than that?
Yeah, my first contact with psychiatry, I was an adult. I was 28, okay? And I honestly, it was right after a suicide attempt. And when I first got psychiatric care, I did feel that there was a hope in psychiatry, but that's before I ever took a pill or had a side effect or had a doctor tell me you have to be locked up or anything like that, okay? So a person may first initially have that hope in psychiatry, but if they're in psychiatry, it won't take long for them to know that, you know, once that first drug doesn't work and then the doctor says, oh, well, we tried the wrong drug, let's try this drug, you stop feeling hopeless.
Right. Well, because absolutely. Prior, if you don't know anything about this and you think that, you know, somebody says, oh, well, you should go to a psychiatrist because they're going to help you, your general practitioner sends you or something like that, then, yeah, absolutely, you would think that this is going to be hope. And some people even at points have described that it did give them hope, that they had some name to put on this thing or whatever, and then later found out that it was very different than what they expected. Yeah.
Literally a dead end, because it kills you sooner. What people fail to realize, you know, all right, psychiatric drugs can worsen the feelings of suicide, depression, or whatever it is you're taking medicines for, okay? It can increase those feelings, okay? So you're not told that. Doctors, I mean, when you first go in there, doctors admitted those things after the symptom, after the side effects started. But before I ever took a pill, it was, oh, Maria, everything's going to be all right. And they put their hand on my hand and says, everything's going to be okay from now on. You know, that whole compassionate you know, join us. We're going to make you happy again. You know, it is not your fault. I'm not saying it's anyone's fault that people feel that way. That is true. But it ain't medicine that's going to make me feel better. You know what I'm saying? And but that's what they want you to
think.
That's
the point. Yeah, that's exactly the whole point. It's not necessarily the medicine that's going to make you feel better. If you just stay on the line, please. I want to bring in also Area
yeah,
Code 614.
Please.
Your line is open.
Hi, it's Catherine. John's mom.
Hi, Catherine. How are you?
I'm okay. We're busy getting our brief in on jurisdiction, hopeful that the court will see the light and order John discharged, and we can get on to the next step. But in the meantime, it seems like, I don't know, I spoke with an attorney who did one of these cases back in the 70s, and he noticed that at the end, when the hospital is about to lose their grip on somebody, which hopefully this is about to happen, some of their abusive behavior can escalate. I'm kind of concerned about that. And instigating type behavior, which...
toward John.
Yes. Let's see if we can't set him off so that he might say something or do something so that we can label him again with something
right,
else.
And give evidence for why this needs to be here. Catherine, for listeners who may not be aware of what you're talking about and who may just be listening for the first time or haven't heard you before, would you just give a brief
right.
background?
Yes. I don't know. John may be on the line himself. But in any case, John has been involuntarily committed since about 2010, the last few years at Appalachian Behavioral Health Care in Athens, Ohio. Forced drugged since 2011. Both of those orders, to all appearances, totally illegal, according to state law, federal law. You know, it's a full-time job just keeping up with all the legal violations. John got into the system just having a rough patch during 2006-2007. Got into the mental illness system. Was given SSRI drugs. And John's had a lot of trauma in his life, and not a lot of understanding, and so somehow or other, he's got a lot of inner resources though, and he's pulled himself up by his bootstraps, and you know, he's ready to leave the hospital, and he's been ready for quite a while. And
they won't let him go.
No. No. The system isn't even set up to let people go. It's set up for this conditional release thing, to where they keep their hooks in the person. And even when you try and explain to the legal system, you know, the statute that actually does still provide, you know, for other ways of being released without conditions, they don't get it, or they act like they don't get it. No, we always do it this way. We always do it this way. That we always do it to where, you know, the hospital keeps its grip on these people. That's not the only way.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and then I'm sure conditional release also implies things like continued forced drugging and things like that, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, it absolutely does, and monitoring in the community and all that stuff, which means, you know, in some ways, yeah, with the threat of hospitalization always dangling over the person's head. Yeah. So it's just, you know, more torture.
Which is a horrible experience for anybody to have. And John, if you're listening, you know, you're always welcome to come on and talk, and I thank you for listening. Is there something specific that people can do, or in the ways that people can let others know that John has support.
Yes, I think it's particularly at this stage where, you know, we're hoping, you know, we may be wrong, but, you know, we're hoping in this next week that something will happen, and that in the meantime, we're you know, I'm concerned that there will be an escalation of the hospital's behavior, and I think it would be good for them to know that people are people are concerned about John, and if anybody can, and you know, I'm willing to help with this too, you know, for I know there's others who are out there with loved ones in facilities. I think it helps the facility to, or it helps the incarcerated person to not feel alone if they're called, and to where the hospital knows that people are watching.
Calling.
People
yeah.
are calling. People are aware he's there.
Is there a number?
Different people. Yes. Yes. This is the number. It's area code 740.
740.
594. 5000.
5000. And John is okay
and
with
then
this
when they
doing, right?
Yes. When
okay.
when they answer, you get a machine, you hit zero, and then you ask for one north, and then you ask for John by name, John Rohrer, R-O-H-R-E-R.
And do you know what time the phone operates from, or is it 24 hours?
Yes. From early in the morning until 11 Eastern time at night.
Okay. So you heard it, folks. Give John Rohrer a call at area code 740-594-5000. Hit operator and then one north, and let him know that you support him, and let them know that people are watching. Because it is. I think what you're talking about of the at the end that they start to push you in different ways. The things that were always acceptable now all of a sudden become a problem because they were things that, you know, you may have been lax on the rules that I remember it. I remember it well. And then they say that it's just that your quote-unquote symptoms are, you know, it's too much stress for you to get out, and so that's what the problem is.
Lauren, I want to ask Catherine if she did hear of the success Eric had.
Anthony.
I mean, hearing about was it the wrong word? I can't remember the name. The man that,
Anthony,
the man,
yeah.
Anthony, I thought it was
Anthony,
Eric.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, that's fine.
Because,
no, I haven't. No,
Oh, Lauren, you can tell it better than me.
He won. He got up and he testified, and he won in his AOT after more than 2 years. His time in involuntary outpatient commitment was finally ended. And he's going to be calling in again. He got it's officially it's over for him. It's over. So I'm amazed at what it did. And he said in part he thinks part of what it was that he got on the stand and he answered the questions honestly. And
I think that will be the case for John too. I think once they see the person testifying and rationally, calmly. Intelligently, you know, it kind of bursts their bubble, their preconceived ideas about what to expect.
Right.
You know, after they've read all these psychobabble reports that with the labels and the out of context little quotes to pathologize the person, then they actually see the person live. Yeah, I think that makes a difference.
That was in New York, in Rockland,
yeah.
in New York. Yeah, I think that this was part of such a huge win for Anthony, of course, but just for all people to know that if you get up and do that. And I remember thinking, like, how does somebody sit there and listen to this without, like, I would lose my mind. I'm just getting an email. Do you want me to call? Yes, yes, yes. I want you to call. he's gonna call in.
He just did that today?
This was just sometime in the last week. Yeah, yeah, so exciting, so very exciting. Yes, Anthony, if you're out there, please call in. And so it's yeah, and so I think it's important for people to know that people can get out of it and they can move, you know, successfully show in the ways that that happens. So he's going to call in a moment, and I just want to again give out the phone number to call John Rory to let him know and let people know that he's got a lot of people who are out there supporting him. It's area code 740-594-5000, and then hit 0 for the operator, and then ask 1 north. Okay, so Anthony's going to call in like 2 minutes. So, Maria, yeah, great to even think to bring that up, because I think that...
Why not? That's a fantastic victory, and hopefully if John is listening, it will brighten up his hopes.
Yes.
Because the thing is John... going to beat this, you're going to prove exception to the rule.
Because a lot of times they
because you have a mother there fighting for you.
They try and make you think that resistance is futile, you know, and sometimes it's easy to get bogged down in that mindset. No matter what you do, we've always got it covered, John. Even if you win this one, we'll pink slip you. That's what they call it in Ohio. Anybody familiar with that term?
No.
Pink slip you? Yes. That's what they call it in Ohio. When one commitment stops and they just do it to, well, it could be an initial commitment. It's an so-called emergency commitment. And they can keep you for 72 hours and then they have to eventually give you a hearing within 30 days. With rights and everything. So...
And so
we're expecting that. We're expecting, even if the court finds it has no jurisdiction, that they will be poised to grab him for the pink slip.
It's horrifying that this is a system that's supposed to be quote unquote help, right? And this is what help is.
Mm-hmm.
Anthony, your line is open.
They use terrorism.
Yeah.
Hi, Lauren.
Yeah. It is terrorism. Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Good. Thanks for listening in and calling in.
You're welcome. Yeah. Actually, more good news. I had spoken with a lawyer earlier today, and it is official. My order to terminate the OT was signed on Wednesday, so it's official. So it's in the history book. So I've got my copy soon, and I'm all clear of that sort of stuff.
Are you free now? Are you still in the hospital?
No, I'm out. I'm a free man now. I have no AOT designation. I'm not required to fulfill anything that they tell me to do. I have to do anymore. I'm pretty much free on my own now.
That's wonderful.
And yeah, and I think it's great. Anthony, would you talk about your experience on the stand and how that may have been different than?
Yeah, sure. It was basically, I didn't even have to, go up to, the stand and sit next to the judge. They just had me sit there in the chair that I was sitting in. And my attorney asked me some questions, basically just some general questions. What's my employment? Where do I live? What's my living arrangement? Do I have any future goals? Will I continue to take medication if I'm not in AOT, stuff like that. And then the prosecution asked me questions regarding the past a lot, my previous hospitalizations, why haven't I taken my medication, stuff like that. They were basically trying to harp on the issue, well, you're not going to take your medications, right? You're not going to take your medications, right? They kept on trying to trip me up and make it seem like I wasn't going to take any sort of medication or anything like that when I was off AOT. They just wanted to make me seem like I was going to be irresponsible.
Did you or your attorney make a record that you had objections to the medication, the drugs? I don't like calling them medication because of the adverse reactions and that, you know, there's really not a whole lot of science behind these. Did you do anything like that, or did you just try and kind of go along with what they said?
Well, I was just, I told them that my main objection was with the injectable. Because when I was on AOT, one of the requirements of being on AOT is you have to take an injectable. In many cases, mine in particular, you had to take an injectable injection, a drug. And that was my main objection, and that was documented, yeah. But I don't think she documented the facts that the drugs are harmful.
Okay. Yeah, in our case, we've documented like crazy, you know, all the studies that establish how harmful they are, and we've been on about this for a year now in writing. You know, all the lawsuits and everything, and I have some concerns that, you know, there's going to be retaliatory, you know, action because of that. But at the same time, they may decide that they don't want us shooting our mouths off to any more of an audience than we already have.
It's such a battle. Catherine, I have a question here that's coming in from somebody about whether or not you ever had any interactions with NAMI, and if so, how did they respond?
Yes. Yeah, I did once. I contacted, well, a couple times. But, I mean, no, they're, for example, the NAMI in Athens, Ohio, I think is housed on the same grounds as the hospital. I mean, they're all friends. But the
nothing
people
like
at the
separation.
Hospital.
Huh?
Makes
for easy visiting. I don't know.
Right.
This person is also saying that you should give a workshop at NAMI to inform other families.
Well, I think everybody knows it's essentially an Eli Lilly front group. I don't think it's just Eli Lilly, but other pharmaceutical companies fund them. They get a lot of money from Big Pharma. I spoke with one guy from NAMI, and, you know, he was polite and everything, but and he was going to talk to somebody at the hospital for me, I think, and get back with me. He never did.
I didn't expect much. Yeah, I was going to say, I wouldn't expect much. I would actually expect that they would say, oh, this is for the best. You should just, you know, accept it. That's what I would think their response would be.
Right.
But I do think that, like, people need to realize, like, this is so common, and there's so many people who are subjected to this, and that once you get in, you're stuck in there, and so to try to find alternatives to whatever it is that you're doing or looking for. Very often some people are not looking for anything, and that's the hardest place to be. Anthony, I know you may be having a million other things to be doing. Do you have anything else you wanted to add?
No, I was just, like, when I was going through the whole AOT thing, like, I thought I was going to be on it for a long time. Like, I thought I was going to be on it for years and years and years, and that was my fear. But I was just glad, like, anybody out there listening, if you're given an opportunity for a second court hearing, take it, because when I had my first court hearing back in June 30th, my initial length of time that they were asking for the AOT order was for a full year, and that judge knocked it down to 6 months. Then I was given the option by my lawyer to go for a second hearing, but with the risk of having the AOT extended for a full year, even though I was knocked down to 6 months the first time. But I took the second court hearing, and I wound up winning. So now, instead of having to wait 6 months until December, I'm free and clear of it. So if anybody out there, if they're given a second chance and a second court hearing, just take it and take the chance, because it's better to do that than having to wait, you know. That's my advice in regards to that.
I think that's really, and I'm just so happy for you, Anthony. Congratulations. What a huge, huge victory. And what are you going to do now that you're free?
Well, I'm definitely going to be working with the therapist I've been working with, not the cord order therapist. I'm finished with that clinic. I'm no longer going there anymore, and I'm no longer taking injections. But I was seeing a therapist privately, which he helped me greatly, and he actually testified for me. I won't say who his name is, but he testified on the stand for me at both court hearings. I'm going to continue to work with him long-term, probably permanently. And I'm doing other things with him on the side as far as my spiritual development goes. But and as far as medication goes, I'm going to continue to take the medication for now until I could find a psychiatrist who I can trust who will work with me. And once me, my therapist, and the psychiatrist feels ready, then we'll work out a plan to titrate me off the medications very slowly. I'm going to be very conservative about it. If it has to take 2 years to get off the medication, or up to 2 years or however long it takes, that's what I'm willing to do. But I'm definitely not going to go off cold turkey because I've tried that in the past and had problems.
Right. And as far as, like, not having to go to all these things anymore, how does that free up your time? It must be really nice to know that you don't have to stop what you're doing or compromise plans because you have to be, you know, at place.
Oh, yes. My time is a lot more freed up. I'm able to do more things with my time, be more productive. I don't have to worry about a 960 pickup order being issued if I don't show up to a therapy session or an injection treatment or anything like that. I don't have to worry about being thrown into an inpatient if I don't show up to my sessions. I am basically free I'm free of, like, those types of threats, and I don't have to worry about it, and there's not that type of stress on me anymore. And it's a very good feeling. I hope...
Can I ask you something? Were you in the hospital for any length of time all at one time?
Yeah, I had a few hospitalizations in the past. That's why they had me on the AOT.
The AOT,
like,
it's involuntary outpatient commitment. Catherine, just in case you don't know that.
I figured it was. Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm just wondering about the experience of being inpatient for years and years, and then being free. I mean, that's got to be a shock to the system. To suddenly be free, if that would happen, I'm thinking ahead, for John.
I bet having a support system in place is going to be an important part of it. I mean, just so many things have changed in the last. I mean, the technology moves so rapidly that even just things don't look the same. There aren't the same kinds of things available in the environment as there were before. Like, just there are so many different changes in the actual world that, see that entirely. Like, that of being, but I think having, being, you know, connected to the internet, I don't know what I would do if it wasn't for the internet. You know what I mean? Like, that is the key, having a phone to be able to communicate with somebody at any given point, and the internet of where you can find like-minded people that will support you. Yeah. I think that's a big piece of it. And Anthony, when does school start?
After Labor Day, I believe September 4th or 5th.
Awesome. I'm just finalizing my syllabi now, and I was thinking about you. Yeah, so it's that's going to be great. And I'm just so happy for you, and I think that there really should be some kind of focus about how wrong these people are. Like, they shouldn't have only ended it, Anthony. They should have ended it with a sincere apology to you for what you've been put through over the last several years. That, you know, how one needs to defend themselves in these ways and for all that you've been through and for all that you survived, I just really think that you are an inspiration to people, and that you continue to fight for yourself until you won. That it really, should be, when you're ready, people should know exactly what you did and how you did it, so that they can maybe follow in suit.
Oh yeah, I do plan on sharing my story. I've spoken with some at least one individual already about possibly writing something about it. I may even one day write a book of my own and have it published because I'm actually a natural writer, so I'm pretty good when it comes to writing. I am actually a better writer than I'm a speaker. But, yeah, I'm definitely going to get the message out there. And also one other thing was, as far as the schooling goes, I was told by psychiatrists that I wanted to go back to school and get a degree and try to better my life and better my life situation. And I was told that those are delusions of grandeur. And actually, now that it's actually going to happen and I'm actually enrolled in school, the bill is already paid, it's going to happen. It's like, you know, which is just ridiculous sometimes, the things they come out with.
These are the biggest violations of all. I mean, they really, truly are, because how many people's lives are the idea of that this is a quote-unquote delusion. And remember, delusion is what the Declaration of Principles calls an unpopular belief. And, of course, it's an unpopular belief that you're going to be able to better yourself and get out of the situation you're in, because then you wouldn't need the good doctor to be forcing, you know, their methods of torture on you. You know what I mean? Like, so what else are they going to call it? Because if you can do what they can do, then why do you know, that's just part of it. And people being told, I have a particular, because I was told that it was, because I said I was a writer, and they said that was evidence of my delusions. And so, like, that kind of thing, it's such a slam against somebody's humanity and gifts and talents that they may have. And if people are being told that, I think it was Ed Knight who said, you know, your delusions, those are your dreams. Those are your goals and dreams, and people should hold on to them. And so I'm just so proud to know you, Anthony, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because you really have on every level showed these people how wrong they were and won. And it's a really inspiration and hope for other people, I think.
Yeah, and Lauren,
yes,
it's definitely
an inspiration to us. Thank you, Anthony.
You're welcome. I tried my hardest, and I'm hoping that there are others out there that are listening that are under an involuntary outpatient commitment order, that it could be done. I thought it couldn't be done. I thought I was going to be on it forever, but to my surprise, we won, and we got a win for the good guys, at least for us one time. And it's a small victory in the larger war on the oppression that goes on with psychiatry in this country and on the whole planet. Actually, this goes on all over the place. So, and Lauren, I think I already told you this. If you ever wanted somebody to speak at one of your classes about this sort of thing, I'm willing to talk about it. So, and good luck with your new teaching assignments.
Thank you. Yes, and I do, and I will. And, and so now I have 5 days a week. So whichever day works best for you, let's figure that out, because I think people hearing from you and seeing you and that it just breaks down so much of the discrimination and the caricatures that people put forward about who we are and what we are. And I think it would be a huge benefit to the students, quite frankly. So thank you. Yes. And also for calling into the show and talking about it and having it be something that, people can learn from and really relate to. And, and I think that's also been very, you've been very generous about your experiences here. And so thank you for that also.
You're welcome. I just thought it was important to get that type of message out, and just for people to know what's going on. I think it's very important. It's a very important thing to be sharing, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And so we persist and continue, and that's great. And so yeah, please do keep us updated, and I'll get in touch with you this week, and we can maybe set up some times, or spontaneously you could just pick one, whichever works better. And Catherine, if I can again give out John's number, if people to show your support to John and to let people at the institution know that John has a lot of people who are supporting him, you can call area code 740-594-5000 and then hit 0 for the operator and then ask for 1 North. And when you get to 1 North, ask for John Rohrer. And Catherine, what's the next steps with what's happening with John?
Well, I think the court is going to decide whether it's going to discharge him sometime this week, whether it has jurisdiction or not. But it's still got a trial scheduled for September 12th, 15th, and 16th. So it's almost like they're already going to decide that they're not going to discharge him. I don't know what that's about. It's sort of a just-in-case setting for
like
September 12th,
like a rain date.
15th, and 16th. Yeah, yeah. So to keep us guessing, and if he's not discharged, he will not be. Then we'll have to put on evidence. They'll have to put on evidence. We'll have to put on evidence, and we have plenty of it. And ours is actually accurate and admissible, and theirs isn't. So. Even if it does go to September 12th, 15th, and 16th, I think we'll be in good shape. And it will be disappointing for it not to be earlier, though. But, yeah, it would be good if we have to go September 12th, 15th, and 16th for people to be able to be there. The court is in Ross County, Chillicothe, Ohio, an hour south of Columbus.
Ohio.
But I will be keeping you posted about what happens later on in the week that's coming up.
Right. I think that if you would, that would be really helpful, and I hope it doesn't have to go to the point of where you need to go to trial, and that's a terrible game they're playing with the idea that we might have just as a backup, we've got this scheduled out. But I understand mm-hmm. that. There have been some affidavits that have been put together about
yes.
human rights violations and such like that. And I'm just off the top of my head, and I don't know if it would do any good, but a lot of what my research showed was the iatrogenic effects, the psychiatric places are bad places and do damage to people. And if you needed any kind of statement about how damaging psychiatric institutions are, I could probably put one of those together if you think it would be helpful.
Oh, yeah.
And so in the next couple of days, I'll try to put that together, and I'll send it to you and see, because I think that there's so much evidence dating back at least to the 1950s about these institutions being places that damage people and that don't help in healing or anything like that. And so I just wish the very best for John to be able to get out, and I hope that it doesn't go to that extent and that the fact that they have no evidence.
I want to acknowledge the support that we've had from Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, who filed an amicus curiae brief with the court earlier this month, or maybe it was the end of July, I can't remember, and the International Society for Ethical Psychology and Psychiatry, who also filed an amicus curiae brief with the court, and we should have in the mail now an affidavit from Tina Minkowitz from the United Nations explaining the position of the United Nations against forcible treatment of any kind, forcible drugging, forcible hospitalization. So we plan on using that.
Wonderful.
To attach to one of our briefs. So hopefully that will have an impact on the court that these are serious, serious human rights violations that have been going on not just at the hospital but also in the court. The whole history of the court case has been one human rights violation, one constitutional rights violation after another. It's just a full-time job to keep track of all the violations.
Right. I mean, the idea that, you know, that there was even no evidence ever presented, and meanwhile, per my understanding through Sharon Kressinger's article on what was happening with John, that he's, like, being thrown down onto the floor and shot up with drugs over his objection and, like, being tortured every day while he is being held in this place, and that this is, that, you know, that this is continuing to go on while, you know, he is, has no relief from what they're doing to him while there.
You know, various hearings that have been scheduled, and we have insisted on John's rights to a public hearing for him to be present, for the public to be present. We fought that battle for about 4 or 5 months, and finally he's been allowed to be present, but because he began resisting the shots in May and June, he's not resisting them anymore. He's just letting them inject him because they're labeling him as dangerous for resisting what is actually an illegal forced drugging order. Anyway, so they're labeling him as dangerous because he exercised his legal right to resist. So now, when they bring him to court, in the last time, which was July 30th, they brought him to court shackled to a belly chain and then handcuffed to the belly chain. And he had to sit like that at counsel table with his attorney. He couldn't even write notes to his attorney because every time he tried to move his hands, he couldn't write. He couldn't, you know, effectively communicate with his own attorney. They took away his internet, you know, so that he couldn't access legal materials online as he had been allowed to. This is all punishment for resisting the risperdal injection.
It's so horrible that this can happen, and then that imagery, as if this is what needs to happen. You know, like, what kind of fair trial can you have if this is the imagery of how you're being presented to a judge? You know, the way the dehumanization of it, and just how it adds to the fraud. You know, like that this, but the punishment and the fear of punishment, I think, is a genuine thing that, and is well documented that this kind of thing happens in institutions all the time.
Well, but yeah, to have it countenanced by the, I'm sorry, by the judge, you know, it was shocking, and that's why it was so important for these hearings to be public. There's a certain accountability that happens when the public can be present during these hearings and can see. And a lot of times judges don't like hearings to be public, but they need to be public for the public to see just how litigants are treated. This is the only type of lawsuit in which one's opponent can drug the person into a stupor the day before court.
Right.
Excuse me, Lauren. I just want to say a couple words of encouragement to Kathleen and John of the parent listening. First, I know there's a tinge, and I don't want to read into something that's not there, but you seem a little discouraged. Please don't be discouraged. There is a great deal of hope, because even if you do have to go to court on the 12th of September, this will, you can win this.
And oh, yes.
If you set a precedent, you will affect the future Johns out there.
Yes.
So don't, I mean, no one wants to go to court. I'm not wishing that on you. But if it has to go to court, just think how much more a victory it will be. Because then it will be on record that another client that is being mistreated can go and say, it is proven that this happens. It happened. The judge said so in such and such the case. If I'm correct in assuming that's the law, that they can bring it up in future cases to say a president was there. And I'm not even sure I'm saying the word right, but I think you understand what I'm saying. Please, there's a lot of people out there rooting for you, and, you know, it's wonderful that a mother is by his side, because a lot of those patients or clients or victims don't have that. And I am sure
yes.
that your son has the confidence, if nothing else, he has the love of his mother, which a lot of people who suffer from these instances, you know, the mother believes what the psychiatrist says. The mother is on the side of drugging. And so,
mm-hmm.
you know, and your experience with NAMI is because it wasn't stronger because you don't believe in the drugging. So it's very one-sided with that organization. So, but there are hundreds, and I would say if more people knew, it would be in the thousands that would be there rooting for you. And I am a praying person, so I'll be in prayer. And then let us know if you actually have to go on the 12th, because we'll send up a lot more prayers and thoughts for you guys, because this will be a victory for not just John, but everyone who's ever been in forced treatment in inpatient spaces.
I think we have some good laws in Ohio that actually, if they were enforced, you know, should be a model for the rest of the country.
Right,
but
the sure
they're just not being observed.
It would be affecting Ohio, and you know, you sound like you've got the arguments down pat. And if anyone
yes.
who is against you is listening in any way, shape, or form, they're going to encourage the judge to say, drop the whole thing. You know, they are not going to want to meet you in court because, no one really wants to go to court, but the victory will be so much sweeter for all, even
mm-hmm.
your own son, if they could admit, the court can say, you are wrong for doing what you did to this man. And that's what they would have to say when they came to the conclusion and rule, you know, that he was held against his will for no legal purposes. And
right.
so, and I imagine you could, if you get that ruling, you could even have a what is it called, civil case?
A civil suit.
Yeah. So, you sound
to a
very
degree,
organized.
That, you know,
yeah.
there's the Ohio legislature has made things pretty easy for doctors as far as being sued. Yeah.
Well, what about the institution
very short statute
itself,
of limitations
though.
And yeah.
Well, no, but the facility that he's in, aren't they held responsible in some sort of way?
They have some responsibility. I think we can show malice and bad faith, and I think it's premature to get to that point.
Mm.
You know, right now I want the abuse to stop.
Right. And I think that is definitely where we need to go. I mean, I want to give out the number one more time for people to tomorrow. From early in the morning until late at night, and maybe even tonight, who knows, you might be able to catch him a late night shift on 11 o'clock. The number to reach John Rohr is area code 740-594-5000. When you get through, hit 0 for the operator, and then ask the operator for 1 north. And then when you get through, ask for John Rohr and let him know that you support him and that you send him good energy or give whatever you're going to do and talk to him. Because I think that, again, if the institution is aware that people are calling in, and to John, I hope you are listening in. And anytime you'd like to call in yourself, please do. You know that. And then so Catherine
thank
and Maria
you.
And Anthony, I want to thank you all for calling in. I also want to just mention, and I hope that Catherine, I don't want to cut short on this because I think it's so important and I really appreciate you giving us updates. But if you would update us again as soon as you have any other information, and I'll make sure to keep on getting that number out to people, that would be really, really great. But I also today, just on a local New York City issue, did receive a copy of the Department of Mental Health Consumer Advisory Board bylaws, the draft for discussion version 1, and where it says additions and corrections are in italics. And under Article 3 for membership and terms of service, under D1, it says members are responsible for proper behavior at all activities of the Consumer Advisory Board and will be subject to suspension or removal from the Consumer Advisory Board based on any type of abusive behavior, whether verbal, physical, sexual, or physiological. Under Article 2, per Article 120 of New York Penal Law, Law of Menacing, and Penal Law 240, Aggravated Harassment, any committee member that exhibits threatening behavior such as abusive yelling, violent language, intimidating physical stance, or gestures will be immediately mandated to leave the meeting, event, activity, or industry-associated event involving Consumer Advisory Board. The dismissed members would not be able to return until after a decision of disciplinary review made by Consumer Advisory Board. All violent physical acts are subject to prosecution. Obviously, a violent act is criminal. I'm not arguing that. Abusive yelling, violent language, intimidating physical stance or gestures, like in New York City, first of all, where people are kind of famed for talking with their hands, you know, like this is this is ridiculous that this would be added into the Consumer Advisory Board membership in terms of services, bylaws. And so this will become a subject tomorrow night. I just am getting this in. I will read it in full, and hopefully some people from New York City who may be listening now or will be calling in tomorrow will be willing to chime in on this idea of penal law being brought into the bylaws of the Consumer Advisory Board. So I'm assuming that I would get kicked out within 3 seconds, right? Aggravated harassment, because maybe I, like, you know, threw my hands up in the air and said, psychiatry is a fraud, really loudly. That's it. That's it, you're done. And if you don't leave willingly, we'll call the police because it's in our bylaws. And you agreed. Good consumers, be good consumers, everyone. It makes me so very mad. But there are wins, and Anthony just had a big victory, and John is going to have a victory, and every step forward, we're going to keep on moving, and people will keep on speaking out, and we're going to keep on holding people like Representative Tim Murphy and Dr. Ken Duckworth responsible for the way that they are exploiting situations of people and limiting, putting out messages that limit our civil liberties and commit more of a fraud on the American public and the world. I'm expecting soon, Yvonne, I hope you're having a wonderful time in Geneva and with Cindy Fisher and others, getting your perspectives on the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Disparities to the United Nations and all of your work there. And I look forward to updates. We will be scheduling some more specials in the upcoming weeks. If you know of a human rights violation that you think needs to be exposed or have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest, please give a call to the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. That's area code 718-273-8708. I want to thank you all for listening in and speaking out, and I'm going to ask you to keep speaking out until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon. Good night, everyone. Thank you.
Good night.